Buttheads. Welcome back to the Bob Zemeckis is Not a Butthead podcast. I am Richard.
And I am Kyle.
And
hey, Richard.
What are we talking about today, Kyle? What are we talking about, Kyle?
We're talking about Back to the Future, Richard.
Yeah,
it's finally
we made
here.
It. We made it.
I think when we decided to first do this podcast, we decided that we would record episodes up until Back to the Future and then release, because we figured that's where a lot of people would want to engage with Zemeckis. That's sort of where, in some ways, the story begins, though in our previous episodes, we realized there was quite a bit more story to it than that. But here we are, Richard. We did it. Back to the Future.
Oh, man. And it's so awesome to watch Back to the Future, having watched I Want to Hold Your Hand and You Scars. So this at the outset, this is the first episode you're listening to, like, go back and watch, find I Want to Hold Your Hand and find You Scars and rewatch Romancing the Stone and then go back to the future again, because it changes the way you see the thing.
And that's sort of one of the things we discussed early on, was this idea that you know, would by the time if we just merely tried to seriously engage with Robert Zemeckis' earlier work, you know, his first couple films leading into this, would by the time we made it to Back to the Future or Forrest Gump, would we be radically reappraising it in some way? And it's not something that we, not to say that we didn't, I mean, these are all films that we loved before, but even then, as many times as I saw Back to the Future, I have a renewed appreciation for it and just see it differently as sort of the culmination of the experimentation that was going on, what he's been striving for with I Want to Hold Your Hand, with Used Cars, and with Romancing the Stone. You kind of finally see it all synthesized in a really cool way with this movie. And so it was just kind of cool to see it, in fact, with new eyes this time around. So did you have that experience, Richard?
I did. And I think part of that new experience was doubled because I think it was the first time I had watched it high. So there was like the one of the, and I don't want to get, not to get too deep into specifics, but like the one thing that, like,
you've set a tone, Richard, for this podcast.
Oh my gosh. Like the one thing I think watching it again, the thought that came into my mind is everybody always talks about how Back to the Future is a perfect movie. It's a perfect screenplay, but we never talk about the direction and how, like, it's impeccably directed, and and I think it has one of my favorite cuts in it that I never really appreciated before, which is just when he goes back in time. That like POV shot in the car where you go from the photo, the photo booth, and then there's just the flash and a cut, and it's just a scarecrow. And like, it's obviously great, but I never sat and appreciated. It's like, that cut is so good. It's so good.
We so take for granted that's one of the better time travel transitions in cinema. I mean, compare that to the ones in Bill and Ted, or compare that to stuff what's done in subsequent films like Looper or something like that, which uses those kind of hard cuts. But I again, nothing can match the rollicking energy of a car spinning out of control, about to hit something, and then it changes into a different object that immediately communicates the time change, and then plows through that object so that it
and
can punctuate the transition with a gag.
And then into it hits one thing and then crashes into another thing. And I think that's probably why I never stopped to think about it, because it's immediately the thing, and then it's a gag, and then it's another gag, and then it's another gag.
Well, and that's the thing, is that I think that certainly, I think that the level on which, and I think Back to the Future has been appreciated, I mean, on that level for a long time, and that people, the way in which, when it's referred to as having like a perfect screenplay, people often use that because it's used as a great example of, you know, of really note carding everything out, and, you know, oh, we see Marty on a when it's brought up like in a screenwriting class, it's usually, you know, you see Marty on a skateboard early on, and later on he skateboards, and it's like, yeah, the thing is impeccably made on that level, but I think that really only kind of scratches the surface. I mean, the craft is at a very high level, but that shouldn't really be surprising, because the craft was on that level or very close to it with I Want to Hold Your Hand. It was there with Used Cars. But, you know, those films, for various circumstantial reasons we discussed, didn't connect and didn't enter the zeitgeist in the way that Back to the Future did. So it's like, to look at the formalism, or to look at just how, you know, yes, it is a very well-structured screenplay. It's like, yes, it is an impeccably made film, you know, that's sort of, it's Chuck Jones meets, you know, Frank Capra meets Steven Spielberg, all swirled together in a whole
Twilight
thing.
Zone, put Twilight Zone in there.
Yeah, it's just it's so many wonderful things, but it's like he like formally he was really strong like right from the get-go, and so it's more like his coming out party is like, yes, this is what I've been bringing to the table for the last several films. But then what's I think more interesting now is to see some of the other things that he was exploring in his movies, the clear, I mean, the nostalgia that's present in I Want to Hold Your Hand, which is all about Beatlemania, to see him take what was sort of an object of his fascination in those films and really turn it, him and Bob Gale and the script, turn it in service of, you know, more interesting, heady and mythic ideas that were very, very relevant to the period in which the film came out, that that I just think make the film so much stronger and made it resonate so much more in that time. So it's like you see like the sum total of his craft and his fascinations finally being all aligned towards the perfect story for that, which is a time travel story, you know, which is, again, perfect for anyway. But Richard, what was your experience of the film this time?
Yeah, I mean, I think it was noticing a lot of the craft stuff that mm-hmm. And like I talking about the time travel moment mm-hmm. and that how impeccably that is handled, and just picking up, there's like two other shots in the movie that like are just so emotionally mm-hmm. Resonant with the moment. Like when he's skateboard, well, you mentioned he's skateboarding. When he's skateboarding in the 50s, holding mm-hmm. on the back of the truck, and the camera's inside the diner and dollying yeah. past all the extras, and the music is swelling, and everybody's cheering yeah. because he's just dumped shit over them. And the dolly moves and then lands right on her face. So you have the stunt, you yep. have the extras, and then you drop immediately into close-up for this big romantic, like, isn't he amazing line, which is just the, like, it perfectly yeah. encapsulates the moment, and then is just like speaks to the layers of what he's yeah. constantly doing. Like, you have the stunt, yeah. you have the extras, you have the performance, and it's all like it's all tied together really efficiently yeah. in one package where the you just read the emotion reads immediately.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, the thing is, like every moment, and I mean, you could really start at any point because the film really just feels like a director almost showing off and kind of joyfully, finally, you know, feeling like he's supported, like just showing off a bunch of what he's capable of doing in that every moment. Each little piece of story information is communicated through these incredible little Chuck Jones skits. You know, it's like when Marty and when Marty and George are first revealed, you know, sitting next to each other. How is it revealed that he's suddenly sitting next to his dad? I mean,
same action.
It's the same. But the thing is, it's not just the same action, but even prior to that, like this is the level of integration that's really kind of interesting, because there's that whole Pepsi free gag that happens first,
and, yeah.
where you don't even realize that the guy is obscuring George McFly, who then moves out of the way so that we don't cut to a new shot, we don't pan over. Literally, George McFly is revealed within the frame, a frame that has them just next to each other so that you can see they're the same silhouette, same movement. So again, all these ideas, that little beat of sitting next to his dad would feel far-fetched, would feel coincidental, but because it's revealed so organically within the frame, we just take it at face value that, like, yeah, of course he would, 5 minutes into entering Hill Valley, run into his dad of all people at this diner, which then speaks again toward the themes of the film on some level, that connection, because is there a mystical quality to why he would
destiny.
Go to exactly the place? It's destiny.
It's
why he
destiny.
Would gravitate to the same place his dad was, yada yada yada. But it's so, again, it's so beautiful. But every moment is that in the whole film.
Right.
I mean, it's what he had in spades in his previous film, and he's just show, like the car stunts and everything's a gag. Every little scene has an amazing visual gag that's thought out. And anyway,
I think that's important though. And just thinking about the movie, everybody's like, oh, but when we grow up and we look back at it, we're like, oh, well, there were some weird things with his like mom in this movie, or like, why is Doc
yeah.
Brown friends with Marty? And,
yes.
and, but the movie is written so tightly and directed so tightly that before you can think about what is happening, the movie is on to the gag. It's on to the next gag. And the reveals are so efficient that you're not thinking about the larger picture while it's happening. You're swept away. Because even in that shot you're talking about, like that shot ends, if I'm not mistaken, with Biff walking in and going, "Hey, McFly." And then they both like lift up and turn. So you have the
Exactly.
You have so, and that's like everywhere in the piece. Like even like one of my other favorite shots is in the beginning of the movie when he's like walking in late for school with Jennifer, and they're like having a back and forth about the band, and then the principal like darts in like a cartoon, grabs him by the neck. It becomes a two shot with them, and then it's this big long take, and it ends in a push-in as he's like principal's yelling him down, and they're touching noses at the end. So it's this big long take that ends in this gag.
It finally gets close enough that you can see the very subtle old age makeup they put on him, which is barely there. Which it's now like, in Blu-ray you can finally pick up on. You're like, what is it? It looks like he has some shit on his face. What the? Oh my god! Look, that's the old age makeup. It's like they all looked the same. No, I mean, again, the same thing we saw. It was a lot of those moments, which was kind of fun to reappreciate them after we saw them kind of anew in Used Cars, where he will, you know, open up on a four shot that goes to a two, that goes to a one, then back out. But it does it all for the purpose of, you know, something cool. It's just the formal aspects of it are just at this point. So delightful that. I don't know. It's one of those things that it allows him to get away with, and by get away with, I don't mean the gloss over problems, but I mean it allows him to get away with being so much bolder and more symbolic with the kind of story he's trying to tell, because he knows that every moment is going to be so buoyant and so delightful that it's going to, you know, demand the audience get on board with it. It's going to reach through the screen, right, and kind of pull them to this side, you know, into the spiritual world. So you're just so empathizing with Marty, and you're there with him, and it's so based in his character and what he's going through that he can, you know, for his own perverse amusement, which you definitely get a sense of having watched Used Cars, and for all of its thematic potential, he can have the mother be in love with the son in a film for families set in 1985, but the rest of the film is so delightful that he can push the story to that place, a place that it would break down, I think, if the film weren't just so utterly delightful the whole time. And it's dancing
on the line the entire time. But
that's because the film is just nothing but a series of these sequences that absolutely demand that the audience get on board. Then that's why when you take a step back after you've enjoyed this entertainment, you can start to look like, wait a minute, like 20 years down the line, the conversation began starting in the pop culture about, wait a minute, how does Marty know Doc Brown? It took like America 20 years to catch up with that question because they were just so delighted with everything.
He has a big amp and speaker.
Yeah,
that's why
and exactly. I really feel that he must have been a grandfather in a previous draft, as I think kind of Rick and Morty has revealed, and that maybe they realize that just doesn't work. That complicates the parents thing, and so
I think it's slightly different because I watched a lot of the behind the scenes stuff with them talking about it, and they were like, the reason I bring up the amp is they were like, oh, we always had Doc Brown and Marty be friends, but we could never explain why they were friends. And then they were like, well, we put the amp in and that seemed to answer that question good enough. So we just put it in and then we open the movie and then it's fine. They're friends.
Which is awesome. The few things what's cool is, I mean, he's just a mad scientist. He even has like Dick Van Dyke's dog from Chitty Chitty Bang Bang. I think in Chitty Chitty Bang Bang, the dog is called Edison and he's called Einstein in this one. Who also like builds a car with all sorts of shit in it, you know, like devices. I love just talking about, I don't want to harp on things like shots through the rest of this, but all of the best kind of oneers, like that opening reveal has this a tremendous quality of revelation to it that also is loaded with so much about what the film is going to be about. Like it's all the clocks. It goes through all the clocks first, with creating this idea of multiple timelines, this idea of time as something material that can be manipulated, really loading in this idea of time, reveals the rest of the kind of Rube Goldberg machines and everything that are his place, and then of course, ends as Marty enters. It reveals Marty and coming with his shoes and enters with the reveal of the plutonium. It ends on the plutonium. But right. again, when the film has that quality of showing off, like any other director would have the camera drift across the floor and end on the plutonium. But he's like, not good enough. Like, well, you can't have a waiter walk by with a tray of glasses to carry the camera over there. So he has Marty drop his skateboard, kick the skateboard, follows the skateboard along the ground, again, getting now the skateboard into our heads already, and then it literally clacks against the plutonium, punctuating that reveal with that sound that kind of pulls you back in. And it's just that little stuff where it's just like, he's just going like 12% beyond what anyone else would do, even if they were trying their hardest.
And even within that shot, you have there's a television news person saying, "Oh, break in at the lab and plutonium mm-hmm. was stolen."
Yeah, yeah.
And one thing I noted, like just the sound design of that opening mm-hmm. shot is so impeccably good, yeah. and that's, that continues throughout the movie. The sound is so great.
But I will say the you know we've touched on like the mom thing, and we've touched on a bunch of the George McFly a little bit. But getting to the plutonium, it was really this time that I began to really appreciate just sort of how much this film is about the relationship between those two time periods and those two generations, and kind of what that means or what that meant as the 20th century began to kind of wrap itself up. Because in Doc Brown's time machine, you have plutonium. It's powered by, you know, something that is highly reminiscent in our minds of some sort of great sin that took place when in the 1950s, in the atomic age, you know, in the age where we sort of abandoned God and took the power of God into our own hands. And Doc Brown, and that's the other thing that I appreciated much more that I just didn't get when I was a kid, is that, you know, Marty's world that he lives in is clearly portrayed as a kind of fallen world. I mean, his mom's an alcoholic, his dad, I mean, those things are obvious, but there's right. trash everywhere. So there's this idea he's in some sort of fallen world, and it has something
porn
to do.
The theater is now a porn theater.
Yes, exactly. He's in this fallen world, and has something to do, kind of, you know, as above, so below, with the parental issue, but also some sort of larger cultural sin. And the larger cultural sin represented by kind of Doc Brown and the plutonium was this. You know, we went all in on science and technology and all of these things which had terrible externalities, and we abandoned, you know, something. We lost something. What is that thing? And
we then, lost of course, time.
The
clock tower.
No, but then, of course,
the
that question.
The clock tower is broken, of course.
The thing that we lost, of course, is then represented when we eventually make it back around to the final sequence. And that, and all of the meaning is right there in the film, in that what replaces the plutonium back in the 1950s? Like, what does it? Literally lightning. Literally a beam of divine light comes down from heaven and infuses the thing with like the power of something as he stands
there.
The
power of love.
He's literally next to a lion, so he has to leap from the lion's head against this clock. Anyway, the point being that as you begin to read the film a little bit more as this dialogue about you're in the 1980s. You're caught in the middle of the Cold War. There's this idea that we did something in the 1950s that could end the world soon. You know, Terminator movies are coming out, all of that. And so his approach to engaging with that idea on some level, rather than making a film about nuclear apocalypse, is to tell all of that idea through this interesting metaphor where where Doc Brown, in a sense, represents the arrogance, and which, of course, that's why Doc Brown is killed, is shot and killed in that opening scene. He is arrogant. He literally is like Prometheus. He steals fire from the gods and is punished for it, and that is his sin. We see him die, and we see that the final extension, like the ultimate conclusion of that sort of loss of spirituality, reliance on technology in the 1950s, that loss of something, that the ultimate result of that is annihilation. And, you know, Marty in a burst of fire, literally being evaporated in fire, returns to the 1950s, ostensibly to, you know, he starts working with his family to try and reconnect with his dad, but really, you know, he returns to somehow correct or save the fallen world that he's in. And how does he do that? We remove from the situation the plutonium, we remove the sin of stealing fire from the gods, and we replace it with literally a beam coming down and striking him on a clock with a lion's head. It's really fucking cool, man. I like this movie.
That's pretty heady, Kyle. I appreciate that. I love it.
I don't think it's heady. I quite explicitly think that that is what the text of the film is telling us. This is what the text of the film is about. I think that which would sound absurd if you held the sort of popular idea that this was some sort of frivolous entertainment, but there's no way to watch his understanding of sort of myth and storytelling in cinema that's present in I Want to Hold Your Hand, that's present in Used Cars, present less so, but more kind of Romancing the Stone is more about art than it is about the world. But in this, you know, you see that he's finally found a way to kind of weaponize his mythic storytelling. I mean, he literally manages to work into a family comedy, as we discussed, the idea of the mother, the sin of the mother is, you know, not holding the son, is something to do with her over-loving of the son, the sin of the fathers basically being their inability to stand up to something. We're not sure, but it's all connected in this really cool way. I don't know. It's just and I just, coming off of watching his last couple of films, you really get an appreciation for the fact that these things were being done consciously, and it really was the difference between, you know, really was the difference maker that made this film connect in the way that it did. More so than, yes, the shots, and yes, they definitely used note cards when they wrote the screenplay, which is usually the comment. It's like, yes, I get it. He definitely skateboards, and then he skateboards again. And it's like, that level of craft was so internalized, I'm sure, by the time they were making this movie, that they weren't even thinking on that level anymore. So anyway,
I mean, the script was 4 or 5 years old before he got a chance to direct it. So of course, all that stuff was mapped. And I think just kind of talking about some of the, to continue that line a little bit. And one of the things that we talked about with the way the story has been told in the I Want to Hold Your Hand and Used Cars, is like the dial is always turned up to 11. All the performances are super big. Mm-hmm. And all of the weird, perverse sex stuff is kind of thrust in people's faces. Yeah. And in this, it's a much more mature, the weird sexy stuff is kind of, it's still present, but it's like pushed to the corners where you're not really thinking about it. It's just like subconsciously there. Yeah. Like the theater is in the back, the orgy is in the background of a big close up of McFly for several seconds in the thing. Seeing the performances, like, they're not the full 11. The actors are strongly evoking the archetypes, very physically. It's not like they're yelling and screaming, but physically embodying the archetypes. So the performance doesn't have to go to 11, but we still immediately read all of the things. And then you can have Marty, who is kind of just existing the middle ground, to react to all these different, like 7, 8, Doc Brown being the 11, right? So it's like this modulation of a lot of different things that I noticed having watched all the way.
I think the performances are, in a sense, just as big and just as cartoony. I think that it really is about there being a more interesting relationship between Robert Zemeckis' style and choice of subject now than there was in those previous films. And the reason I say that is because there's more of a one-to-one relationship between his cartoony aesthetics, which he does very, very, very well. I mean, that is as a compliment, and his obsession, his like perverse kind of obsession with sexuality and being naughty and all of that kind of shit. Like, when you make I Want to Hold Your Hand, it's a film explicitly about horny girls being super, super, super horny for the Beatles and, like, you know, and Nancy Allen fucking that bass. And so it's like, there's not as much dynamic contrast between his sensibilities and the subject, Same thing with used cars. It's literally about firing shotguns and crashing cars. That's like you could feel it's Robert Zemeckis' subconscious just let loose. And I think perhaps what he discovered, I don't know, I have not looked into it, but perhaps what he discovered with Romancing the Stone is taking that hyper-masculine, naughty boy sensibility and having some counter-energy, like this kind of more this feminine sensibility that's there in Romancing the Stone, all of a sudden created something that had not just a much more broad appeal commercially, which it did, but it also just created a film that felt like it had more, even, I don't think Romancing the Stone is as good as Used Cars or I Want to Hold Your Hand in certain ways, but it feels in a way that has more of an dynamic internal life just because, oh, there's a feminine aspect to the film, there's a masculine aspect, they clash and all of that. So when we get to Back to the Future, I think that it's him realizing that, oh, I can have my big cartoony performances and my shots and everything I want to do, but like, let's not make it about like a van full of clowns on fire because let's make a film about something else instead. You know, let's make a film about the relationships between moms and sons and their parents. Let's create like that scene when Marty first walks in and he sees Biff and his dad and him. Like that scene is like Biff's performance is huge. You know, George McFly's performance, Crispin Glover's performance is huge. And yet there's something so kind of grounded and dark and humiliating about the scene that it's just sort of it anchors it in a way that where Used Cars would just sort of spin off into the stratosphere. I don't know that that's making sense, but I think that what's isn't reining himself in, but I think the choice of subject matter is a much more sophisticated one than the one he had on those films.
And I think there's something I did want to talk about that first scene with Biff where it is so humiliating, because I think one of the things that I noticed in talking about tonal modulation, like you still have like that scene reads as like you're right, the performances are big and they're like embodying these archetypes in a way that we read immediately.
Yeah, yeah.
But the scene reads as dark and dangerous. Yeah, yeah. It doesn't read as like a cartoon. Sure, they're cartoon elements, but the Back to the Future has this like element of danger and that's present in that scene. And with Doc Brown being shot, like it's not just this big cartoon silly thing. And we saw shades of that in Used Cars, especially that second commercial bit where he's like, what the fuck? When they're blowing up the cars. Like you have that element of danger in his other films, but here it feels like it's grounded within scenes that add further depth to where we're gonna go. And make it like where we believe that Marty has to drive the car to get away because the Libyans are going to murder him they murdered Doc Brown. Like element of danger is so real.
The entire Libyan element, by the way, if you want to know whether or not the sort of atomic annihilation threat is the subject of the film, it's like what was the prevailing fear, which was characterized more literally in other films like True Lies and other things. What was the prevailing fear at the time of, oh no, we've created this technology. What happens if it gets into the wrong hands? Often the thought of the time that being Islamic terrorism and like someone creates a suitcase bomb and it blows up. And so he's annihilated literally by a representation of what that fear was. I mean, he's literally building the bomb
the
for
nuclear
the Libyan
bomb
terrorists
for them.
Who are going to do the thing, you know? And it's just this interest. And so we finally get to kind of see, okay, it would be one thing if it were just that spy story of like or just the story of him trying to get just the science fiction story of getting back. And it would be one thing if he had a magical amulet that sent him back in time and it was really about him correcting this issue with his parents. But what's so special about the film is that it has that internal spiritual and, you know, kind of melodramatic dynamic with the parents. And the parents are broken apart. He has to get them back together. And this is really about him correcting the sin within his family, which is apparently just it's like the flaw basically being that the mother fell in love with her father because she took pity on him rather than because she was, you know, romantically in love with him or respected him in any way. And that flaw worked its way out throughout the rest of their lives, yada, yada, yada. And that same sin is represented, you know, in macro, you know, terrorists nuclear bombs, the atomic age, and the two things feel for the same reason, kind of as I was like what I was talking about before with the idea of finally with Romancing the Stone, there was a little bit of femininity to contrast the masculinity. I think that the dynamic distance between those two things, and yet they feel so resonant. Like, we love that generation, we have a great respect for that generation, but maybe they fucked something up, and maybe it's on us now to fix it, or whatever that is. The synergy between both the small story, the family story, you know, the kind of as above, so below aspect of it is really, I think, where the film generates that kind of magical internal power. It's kind of the furnace that kind of heats the rest of the house. And then it can use that level of care and empathy and investment you have in all of these symbols and all of these characters and all of that. And it can weaponize that in furtherance of taking what is like a cool Chuck Jonesy car chase and making it feel transcendent, you know? And I think that as much as we talk about, you know, the formal aspects of the film, we don't realize that like the furnace that heats the house is just how much thought I think they had. And I think that's partly because, as you said, we talked about this a while back, but that they wrote the script, couldn't really get it made, and so they had a lot of time, many years. It preceded Romancing the Stone when they wrote it, and the script changed and evolved. In fact, it wasn't on an early draft. The time machine was a telephone booth, right, or something like that.
Originally, I believe it was a fridge. It was a refrigerator. Mm-hmm. That got nuked. They had to go to a nuke test site, and that was how they got the power to be launched back. That was what the original it was originally, which came up.
So yeah. the it was the Indiana. Yeah, remember you told me that was the Indiana Jones fridge gag, basically.
Yep.
That's funny.
Yep.
So literally, so I guess that's
so
it.
You're so right. You're probably right.
Okay. So you're right. I guess I'm right. Is that? Yeah. So I guess we've determined, and I probably, if I had done 1 second of research before this podcast began,
it's all right.
It's
better for me to just let you go and then prove to you that you're right after you've had your moment.
It's so much better than you proving to me that I'm wrong. So quite literally, they had to go into the belly of the sin of the atomic age that was looming with terror, literally represented by terrorists in the 80s, you know. And again, all of that stuff is, it's not like it's not, it's right there, it's obvious, it's to be observed. But I think that because the film is so transporting and so fun and so buoyant and so, I don't know, it's such a good time, I think people are reluctant to engage with it on a deeper level, because they're like, well, I wouldn't have had such a good time if the film had anything serious to say, which I think, thankfully, is a sensibility that I think more characterized the 80s and the 90s than now, where I think where people are more comfortable fusing their art and their entertainment. There at least is less dichotomous now than I feel like it was then when critics just gave all horror movies thumbs down because they weren't the right kind of movie. You know, that kind of era.
Yeah.
We're not in that era anymore.
Right.
But still, I don't know. I think that it's one of those things where so many guys have tried to decode why the film is powerful purely on that sort of materialist level and cool shots and structured screenplay, and then failed, you know, to ultimately replicate that, you know, in other films. And it's like you have to, it's like when you see that, you have to kind of look one layer deeper. And when you look one layer deeper with this film, the plutonium, the beam of divine light, that idea that maybe us pushing into materialism, which is, you know, pushing into technology represented by a holy ball of hellfire, you know, maybe wasn't the best thing. Maybe we're still working on that. Like, all that stuff is right there, and it gives the film, I don't know, it gives the film its power. As I said, it's kind of the furnace that heats the house.
Right, and when you have that base and you're building in archetypes with performances that can exist and live as a cartoon on top of that, like like, of course it's gonna, and then his level of craft on top of that is like it's hard, like your read of it, like, I'll be honest, like this is like awesome for me to just sit and listen to. So I feel dumb. I feel dumb hearing you say all these like crazy wonderful things about the nuclear. It's awesome. I love it.
That's good. I mean, that's good. Well, hopefully if one other person listens to this podcast and gets a renewed appreciation for the level of depth that Zemeckis was bringing to the table, Zemeckis and Bob Gale were bringing to the table, then that is rad. But it's interesting, and this is only something I'm kind of starting to put together now, but I was just thinking about what is that relationship between all of that atomic age stuff, you know, the sins of the atomic age looming over us, and why this particular story about the father, about Marty's father. And you realize that so much of when we question, you know, things in the past, especially if, you know, for those of us who, you know, grew up with, you know, fathers or grandfathers who fought in World War II, you know, my grandfather fought in World War II, there's this idea that if you questioned anything from that time, you would be questioning the judgment, the rightness of your fathers, you know, that basically right. To re-examine these things would be to, you know, humiliate or emasculate that generation in some way. And so basically, you know, Marty lives in this fallen world that is to him, as he then looks at his, as you said, the father, you know, the performances are so big, people represent everything in an instant. When you open that door and you see the big blustery Biff standing there, clearly evil, and you see his father, oh, which one's his father? The one that's slumped and bent and hunched and skinny and like can't look up and his head's always cocked to the side.
There's that great shot of him too in the diner when Biff starts beating on Marty and his father is who's being held to starts laughing, and then he like morphs back into into the attention is back on him. He becomes very very closed off again, which is perfect. It's perfect.
Yeah, and it's perfect just because it. I think it has an understanding. I think that was, you know, it just has kind of an innate or cultivated understanding of why is it difficult for us to engage with these questions? You know, why is it difficult for us to engage with, you know, should we have dropped the bomb? You know, should we have made these things? You know, it's like, I don't know. My dad and my dad's dad seemed to think it was a great idea, you know. I think, you know, I remember, you know, you sort of grow up with that idea that, like literally, I mean, I don't know why I was hesitant to say it's like literally, if they hadn't have dropped the atomic bomb, my father's father would have been part, he was in the Pacific Theater, would have been part of the invasion of the Japanese mainland. So that would have been D-Day times 10. He would have been killed. I wouldn't exist. So that's when it becomes this really weird question. And it was it morally right? Was it morally wrong? Did it save lives? All of these things. And where it gets sticky, what's the feeling tone of that conversation? The feeling tone of that conversation is, it makes me really uncomfortable to think about my dad or my dad's dad being wrong, or because like I feel like I'm the son, I have to defend him. That's literally what Marty is doing in that opening scene. He's seeing his father being humiliated. He's seeing his father being questioned. You know, a feeling tone that maybe some of us, you know, like if your parents go to church and then you see on the news people saying anyone who goes to church is an asshole because of coronavirus or whatever the thing is. You know, it hurts your feelings and you feel like you want to stand up and defend them. You want to do something, and you see that Marty wants to do that. He wants to stand up. He wants to reassert that the goodness of his father, and at the same time reckon with, you know, that mistakes were made. And that is when he goes back into the past and he fixes the problem of, you know, replacing the plutonium with the divine light and all of that. That's just sort of the kind of as above version of the so below version of making sure his father is someone his mom would want to fuck, you know,
right.
Because that's what's been lost.
And,
you know,
and I think that kind of, if you look back at especially I Want to Hold Your Hand and especially Used Cars and 1941, like Zemeckis is pretty critical of a lot of pieces of American society, and you're looking at this one in particular. You're looking at the family unit that we're the kids don't know their parents, the parents don't know their kids. There's no discussion about anything. Sex is like not allowed. You can't possibly go do anything. You can't go fool around with that boy. You can't go meet your girlfriend. Like, and like this, so there's a, an incredible story of like the sexual repression in the American family.
And we haven't even talked about that because we kind of take it for granted, given the fact that we spent so much time gabbing about it on those previous episodes about I Want to Hold Your Hand and about, but yeah, I mean, like, what is I Want to Hold Your Hand but a film about that generational disconnect? Yeah. You know, the child and the dad forcing him to get the haircut, the Nancy Allen being this girl who has convinced herself that she doesn't like the Beatles and that she isn't attracted to the Beatles, which is representative of her even having a sexuality. So she's convinced herself she doesn't have a sexuality because that's what her boyfriend told her, who then is ultimately revealed to be an abusive monster by the end of the film as she then allows her sexuality to flourish when she has the affair with the bass guitar, and then finally
all to say go watch I Want to Hold Your Hand.
And then finally she consummates it during the performance with that incredible shot that literally where she stands. I have to keep talking about it. So if anyone hasn't seen I Want to Hold Your Hand, there's one shot where, and I'll keep talking about it, of Nancy Allen, where the entire film is summed up in a single shot. And it's a transition between, well, a single shot, but the camera doesn't even have to move. It's a Nancy, you see Nancy Allen's adoring, crying face looking at Paul McCartney, and then she stands up and her head in the frame is replaced literally with her loins as she grabs her skirt and folds it between her legs, and you see her shift from the Apollonian to the Dionysian just with this one stand. And it's like that was the whole film right there. It's like that, and it represents her climax of her whole, you know.
It's the climax of the movie. She's climaxing.
Speaking of which, Mary Jo Sperber.
And Jimmy Olsen. So both Marty's siblings are leads in I Want to Hold Your Hand, and they have much bigger parts and are both great. They're both great.
Mary Jo Sperber is a force of fucking nature. So if you have not seen I Want to Hold Your Hand, the Criterion is out. So if you're feeling too fancy pants to watch the rest of Robert Zemeckis' filmography, go watch the Criterion edition.
Yeah, buttheads.
Yeah. We have a very kind of stink face, I'd say, orientation towards Criterion type movies here. Richard, what do you think? Stink face?
I mean, I like them.
I think that people talk about them too much.
It's not the bar of quality that I think we all expect to be. Like, there's some good stuff on there, but
there's other films out there is what I'm saying. Like Used Cars.
Like Used Cars, which is great.
That was the point I was gonna get to about Used Cars, and I wanna hold your hand before I got sidetracked by the whole Nancy Allen shot, was just this idea that Robert Zemeckis is a filmmaker who wants to take, he almost has especially with Used Cars, a kind of Ralph Bakshi-esque quality where he wants to take the sins of America and kind of smear them in America's face. So, you know, and so he takes, it's in Used Cars, it is all about sin and excess and fun, just being like, and hypocrisy being smeared in the face of
everywhere.
The audience.
Literally everywhere.
You know, and again, that same level of hypocrisy and disconnect we see in I Want to Hold Your Hand, and he's true, you know.
Back to the Future.
You can even look at it. We'll look at it even in just what the bully character has represented in each of these films. Because Robert Zemeckis, even in 1941, we see this evolution of this Bob Gale and Bob Zemeckis bully character. So like Treat Williams in 1941, exactly. So you have the abusive and shitty boyfriend that kind of represents on some level, you know, kind of the desire of the establishment to not look back and continue going, and everything's fine, and let's not introduce sexuality, let's not look back and question anything. So you have that bully character represent that in there, and then you see him, but it's mean, it's a little dark. So like with Treat Williams, there's a little bit more humor and buoyancy added into the bully, and then finally when we get to Biff,
but he's still a rapist.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
Wait, was Treat Williams in 1941? I can't remember.
Treat Williams is the bully that's trying to
I can't remember if he tries to.
He tries to grab her and run off with her from that party several times.
There's the swing dancing and all that sequence. Right. Cool. Yeah. No. But it's funny to look at Biff as kind of the ultimate. Like he had bully characters before, a little too dark, still a little not quite there, and then finally we get Biff, who is a bully for the ages. He is the iconic doofus bully who I'm sure when we get to Back to the Future 2, we'll talk about, has become, again, if you question whether or not Robert Zemeckis is tapping into potent themes about, like, generational exchange, I would only look at the non-coincidental fact that this goofy bully character that is present in Back to the Future would go on to become so clearly a Donald Trump analog in the next film. So he's tapping into something elemental and potent that is clearly a powerful force within our society, because I don't think it's necessarily a coincidence that that type of person and how they were being represented and what they were being shown to represent, even in 1985, that symbol would evolve into something far more politically terrifying just a few years down the lane, let's say.
Where we're going, we don't need roads, Kyle. Exactly.
Richard, that has never sounded scarier.
Oh man, but I think that's interesting. And if we look ahead too, and something I wanted to kind of just bring up here, I don't know that I have any answers to it. But if we look at some of the backlash from Forrest Gump, and the criticism of Zemeckis being this like conservative filmmaker, like there are. You can, like, this movie was released in 85. Ronald Reagan is all over the movie in several jokes.
That's another thing that's used to connect those two time periods, you know.
And Reagan, like, came out and, like, was bullish with Back to the Future, probably because he was mentioned, but also, he said in his, like, State of the Union address, never has there been a more exciting time to be alive, a time of rousing wonder and heroic achievement, as they said in the film Back to the Future, where we're going, we don't need roads. So he loved it. When they screened it at the White House, and when he was mentioned as a joke, they had him, like, he ran and had the projector run it back. So
that makes a lot of sense. That makes so much. Well, and it's interesting to examine how Reagan is used in the film, because he's literally the president, he's the person who holds sway. He holds that nuclear hammer in his hand. And yet, when you go back into the past, where is he? He is no longer this person who holds life and death sway over the destruction of cities and worlds.
He's on the marquee of the movie theater in Hill Valley. And you have the Doc Brown joke of, who's president? Ronald Reagan. Ha! Ronald Reagan, a movie star as president? That's crazy.
Now, is that the same building that Marty crashes into when he's going back to the present? Because he crashes into a building at the end of the thing that has a marquee above it. And I believe I'm trying to remember.
So I believe that's the Porn Theater, which was the theater showing Reagan in the past. Yeah. So, like, even that, you have the Reagan being literally crashed into in the future.
And have an awareness of the idea of cinema just representing that portal into the spiritual world, that idea of like, or the dream world, or, you know, if you want to look at like kind of an Alice in Wonderland, like looking glass sort of a thing. Right. So obviously, you know, his transition to the past, you know, is not, if you don't view it literally as him getting in a time machine and going back and going to the past, it is also just sort of a journey into the interior self, you know, into the spiritual world, into essentially figuring out, like trying to just, it's that thing everyone has to do, is reconcile the good and the bad about where they come from, their parents, all of that. He goes into the spiritual world, he goes inside, he reconciles those things, and he emerges, and he busts into a goddamn movie theater at the end, which is a potent sort of an interesting potent symbol for the fact that, you know, how do we reckon with the past in the 20th century, especially this film exists before the internet and, you know, and all of that. We reckoned with it. Certainly someone like Robert Zemeckis and Steven Spielberg and Bob Gale would have reckoned with it through cinema, through looking at
1941,
old movies.
Making 1941.
Exactly.
I think there's one thing I want to kind of bring up and have you kind of maybe continue. You kind of picked it up a little bit before, but when we talked about I Want to Hold Your Hand, you were like, it's the you brought up this idea of Zemeckis's obsession with media and how it is talking about culture, how it is disseminating culture with like the Bobby DiCicco climbing the tower to like chop down the radio tower.
The radio tower.
And we see
because
it
he doesn't. Yep. Oh, and he kind of has a little bit of Biff in him too, because he all of his value as an entity, you know, sexually, is in this 50s greaser aesthetic and all of this stuff he's seeing washed away. He literally says, "I've hit on 7 girls tonight," and no one. So he finally takes an axe to finally try and just stop time from happening.
Yeah, and I think we see kind of that evolution of that. You're kind of posit about this media him looking at how media affects culture with mm-hmm. used cars when they hack into the television broadcasts mm-hmm. and they're showing boobs mm-hmm. showing boobs and then I think we even see some of it in Romancing the Stone, because that movie is about idealizing a man through mm-hmm. literature
yep.
So just I don't have any answers, and I hate to put you on the spot.
I think it's not just Zemeckis. I mean, that's common to so many things. The Coen brothers, you know, use the television screen or the movie screen to represent that kind of passage into the dream world. Quentin Tarantino does the exact same thing all the time. That's why, you know, at the end of the whole first chunk of Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, my favorite shot is, like, of course, the two of them sitting watching the television, watching himself on the other side of the screen, and that whole. You know, they come together in front of that whole looking glass to sort of examine the dreams, to examine the interior life that they've cultivated in the entire film up to that point, and that they are strong as this unit together. I just, you know, and so, and of course, they're filmmakers. So it's like, if you're good, what are they going to use? Fucking paintings? No, they're going to use movies, because that's what they know. And that's how you get. And I just like that idea of using cinema, because it's not unique to filmmakers in the sense that the only art form that as a country, as a people, we actually took seriously as a way to deal with our world in the whole of that century is cinema. You know, when we need to process that someone's lonely and crazy, we think of Travis Bickle. When we want to process that someone has integrity, we think of Atticus Finch. These are the angels that we use, that we collectively throw all of our energy and all of our mental focus at to help guide us through the world. And so, you know, the choice of cinema, you know, the choice of him crashing into a movie theater, the seeing Ronald Reagan on the marquee.
Even Doc Brown just watching himself on videotape.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Oh, yes, yes, yes,
big,
yes, yes.
A big moment. So look at me. I'm so old. The way he says old is so great. I'm so old.
Yeah. But that the whole thing is, it's like it makes sense, because that's how we process generational information for better or worse is through movies and for everything we get from that and everything we also kind of lose in the translation along the way. But yeah, that's kind of how we process those periods, and it's how we process our interior selves. And since this is a film kind of about Marty processing both the fallen state of the world and the fallen state of his interior self, you know, through and how what that says about his relationship to his dad, you know,
and his mom.
And by the way, and also when he transitions into the past, of course, what is he hitting? A booth that processes film. So even though we're in a mall parking lot, you know, that it was originally set in a movie theater parking lot, and they're like, is this too on the nose? So they set it in a mall parking lot and had him crash into a thing. It's like, because I feel like if terrorists were shooting machine guns on Main Street, that like there would be other factors in that whole thing. We'll move it to a mall, he'll crash into a film booth instead. Sure. And for those of you who are younger than us, before iPhones, we used to take pictures on 35mm film like every day, and then you would have to bring it to a place and get it processed
3 to 5 days later.
Yes. And then later on they had 1 hour photo, which was a film starring Robin Williams.
I never saw that one.
Oh yeah, is it Mark Romanek who directed that? One of the music video directors directed that one.
That sounds right.
Yeah. Anyway. One of those music video guys did that one, who makes a movie like every 9 years. Back to the Future. It's such a good fucking movie, man.
Oh my god, it's so good. One of the other things that there were two kind of other trains that I noticed while watching this mm-hmm. time, and the first is how much Star Wars influence there is in it. I didn't really appreciate that before, obviously you have the Marty says to Doc Brown, "You're my only hope," to get him out of the past. George McFly says, "You are, I am your destiny, density," which is obviously a play on Empire. But even beyond, and him saying his name is Darth Vader. But even beyond that, like when I watched the first time travel chase with the Libyans, I was like, "This is the Death Star trench scene." It is.
Oh, interesting.
It is so much the Death Star trench scene.
Well,
and even
that is definitely true with 1941 with which was written by Zemeckis and Gale, where they do the whole trench run, but with planes.
Airplanes. That feels so much like the trench run, because even you have you have the van and the car like swerving, just like had the X-wing in the trench.
Yeah. Oh, that's interesting. Yeah, I like
And we talked about, I talked about it at the start, even that shot of the time travel, the the 1 hour photo booth to the Scarecrow POV shot is jumping to hyperspace. That's the jumping.
Oh yeah. Yeah. That's interesting. Yeah. I like that. I dig that. I wonder though, with some of the things, all the destiny and you're my only hope and all that, was just, I'm wondering, you know, how much of that is also just the fact that clearly, you know, famously,
that's the theme. It's the theme of the movie.
Well, famously, Lucas is, you know, was Mr. Joseph Campbell, who got everything injected into the culture, and clearly based on his previous films, you know, Zemeckis became a student of that type of storytelling, and you know, is very much trying to evoke all of that same mythic and archetypal and Campbellian shit. He's super down that rabbit hole, and so there's a lot of that in there. But I like how, again, we need the Robert Zemeckises to not turn that into, you know, into an epic space fantasy. Obviously, we need the guy to turn it into an epic space fantasy, but we need the guy who takes the moment where the guy fails to seize his destiny and has him say, "You're my density," because that's funny, and funny is good.
Yeah. Anyway, so it seemed like too many similarities pulled from Star Wars to ignore.
Plus, you have to realize how large Star Wars, and then all of the films that were influenced by Star Wars, were looming large in the culture. So there's so many destinies and chosen ones and mentors at the time.
Not to like, and even like, we know Lucas and Spielberg were tight, and Zemeckis and Spielberg were tight. So they were probably buddies and shooting Skeet together several times.
Yes, but even cooler, they were friends with John Milius. So
exactly.
So let's not ignore. We know that Bob Zemeckis and Bob Gale and Steven Spielberg and John Milius shot shotguns together a lot.
And that's
still the coolest thing I've ever heard.
And that gave us 1941. And the other thing that I wanted to kind of just, the other thing that I noticed watching was just a whole host of Spielberg influence, just even the way he's blocking scenes and setting things up, where there's big crazy, and he does this a lot in his earlier stuff, but like a lot it feels like Spielberg being stripped down for Raiders of the Lost Ark, and just knowing he has to get everything under budget, where you have big crazy masters and then an insert to cut around the big crazy shots, and you see that all over this movie. Feels very Spielbergian in that sense, with the Zemeckis touch of the performances being huge and all these long shots ending as jokes. And even we have that classic iconic Spielberg wonder shot where the camera pushes in and floats, which it feels like Zemeckis is thumbing his nose at Spielberg.
Because
with that Spielberg wonder shot, we get that on Marty as the car, as the car comes back from the past with the dog and the thing. So you get the push in on Marty, but you also get the push in on the dog. So the dog itself gets the Spielberg wonder
gets
shot.
That is a very good point. No, you're right. I guess in that sense, what is fun. But my question is, because I feel like Spielberg also has some of that wry sense of humor. And it's like, it's tough, like where sometimes he will use shots like that ironically to set up a joke, sometimes in films written by Robert Zemeckis, in the case of 1941, and what I think is cool, and I have been able to reappreciate about watching all of these films together, and I like that we put 1941 and what else did we add in there? I forget what. One other one. I like that we put all those in there because I just lost my train of thought briefly, but let me think. What was I just saying? What were you just talking about, Richard? Quick, go.
The Spielberg. I was talking about.
Oh, the Spielberg thing is. It's Spielberg tough to know where Spielberg and Zemeckis. Where sort of Zemeckis ends and Spielberg begins, because as we've seen, Spielberg's first executive producing thing was, I want to hold your hand. They're buds. We know Spielberg's on set telling Nancy Allen she's going to fuck that bass. and all of that. So he's intimately involved. These are his people. He takes those actors into 1941, clearly in 1941. He's like, man, Spielberg is saying, I want some of that Chuck Jones, Bob Zemeckis energy in my filmography. He's saying, I want some of that John Milius masculinity in my filmography. By the way, I don't know if we even talked about it on the podcast, but I since saw the teaser for 1941 that was directed by John Milius. Yeah. Oh, yeah. You brought it up and then I watched it later. It was great. Oh, it's so great. But you can see that Spielberg wants to, like, he's seeing his friends do all this amazing creative stuff and he wants to vacuum it all up, and it becomes this sort of proving ground on which he sort of learns all the skills and the gags and the identity that he'll use in his next film,
in Raiders.
Raiders of the Lost Ark, even if 1941 kind of doesn't fully hold together. But so it's it feels like, not so much, it would feel like a mischaracterization to say that Spielberg, that Zemeckis is being influenced by Spielberg so much as we now kind of see the big soup, the big sort of factory in which a lot of the aesthetics that we loved about Zemeckis' filmography and Spielberg's filmography were forged in these collaborations. Because you know, by looking at 1941, by looking at how he produced I Want to Hold Your Hand, by looking at how Spielberg basically took the whole fucking cast of I Want to Hold Your Hand. Oh, and we didn't even talk about Animal House. So Spielberg, like, he's like, I want the cast of Animal House because, you know, because that's hip right now, and I want everyone from I Want to Hold Your Hand, and I want this, the script that was written for John Milius, and I want all this shit.
Get Slim Pickens in here. So I can play Kubrick and the Doctor Strange thing.
Yeah, it's just and I thankfully, what I like is that all of these things that we love about Spielberg, that we associate largely with Spielberg, I mean, they were present in his early films, but have become iconic Raiders of the Lost Ark and on. We see them as part of, I see them now as kind of this collaborative experiment between all of these guys collaborating during this period. And then finally, because their early successes basically afforded them so much fucking money and leeway, they could make this weird shit.
Spielberg can't make Raiders of the Lost Ark without Robert Zemeckis. Like,
no, I 100% agree with that. And that's because, I mean, so much of what Raiders of the Lost Ark is just Chuck Jones shit. You know, I pull out a gun, you pull out a bigger gun. I chase you this way, you chase me that way. Person gets put in a basket, peeks out, whatever. You know, all that, it's just Chuck Jones. And, you know, and if you take a look at I Want to Hold Your Hand, you can see that, I mean, he wasn't the only person doing this at all, but he's taking the biggest swings. He's taking these huge swings. And again, Chuck Jonesy shit is present in Airplane and a lot of other films that connected with the zeitgeist much bigger than like the Zucker Brothers
or
I Want to Hold Your Hand did.
Or
so I'm not saying it doesn't all come from him, but the specific form it takes, you know, you can see a direct line between Zemeckis as a director in I Want to Hold Your Hand and then how it influences Spielberg as a director in in Raiders of the Lost Ark if you watch all of those films in a row. So the influence, I think, is circular because they were contemporaries, you know.
And what's really interesting, Zemeckis had a quote in one of the interviews. He's like, where he says, my technique of telling a story with a camera is a major Spielberg influence. He and David Lean, they're geniuses. I never asked why he took me under his wing, but the beautiful thing about our professional relationship and our friendship is we both admire and love the movies we each make, but we're never in competition. We understand that we couldn't make those movies. Only Steven can make Steven's movies, and only I can make my movies, but I love his movies. And I think that quote kind of comes out of 1941 and Raiders of the Lost Ark and Back to the Future, because like you're talking about, there was that soup where it all kind of mixed together in 1941, which taught Spielberg a bunch, and I think Zemeckis a bunch, just in terms of what the screenplay had to be and
what it's like to be really disappointed a third time.
Right. And like, and I, not to bring up specific shots again, but there's a moment in 1941, I believe it's in the trailer, where it's at the dance party when things have gone crazy, where something happens and Treat Williams shoots up into close up with chaos happening. And that exact shot is in Back to the Future when George McFly or Marty gets hit by the car. But it's used in a comedy purpose. So Marty gets hit and then the guy comes out and is like, oh my God, a kid jumped in front of my car again. And then you see George McFly sit up into frame. And just the execution is arguably much better in Back to the Future, mm-hmm. as it packs so, that shot packs so much story density and thematic density and plot density mm-hmm. into that one moment. But the shots are basically identical, just yeah. basically identical. So it's just, and part of the reason why I thought we should do this is mm-hmm. like, you know, Dave, is huge Spielberg nut, mm-hmm. and yeah. and we both are too. And I think we
this being
all
our friend, our friend, shout out to Dave Blue Garcia, who was a cinematographer on our first film that you produced and I directed yeah. years and years ago. So
years and years
and
ago.
Dave, we would do is just talk about Spielberg and Raiders of the Lost Ark and just Spielberg all day
long
and Zemeckis.
Spielberg.
Yeah, yeah, a lot of Zemeckis. But anyway, you recently Dave saw yeah, I Want to Hold Your Hand for the first time.
Yeah, and now he's on a Zemeckis train. But I think when we were younger, it was like Spielberg, 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 Spielberg. And Zemeckis yeah. has a lot of the same craft things that are like mm-hmm. that you can learn a lot from, and mm-hmm. even just tonally, not just like mm-hmm. the craft, but like tonally, how do you mm-hmm. push? Where do you push? How do you modulate mm-hmm. performances? Where do you put gags in the frame? How what are interesting ways in which things can enter and mm-hmm. leave the frame? Mm-hmm. You see so much in Zemeckis from a cartoony sense. And
yeah.
given,
I would also say that Zemeckis's interests are also just far more peculiar than
yes.
Spielberg's.
Yes, correct.
Spielberg's films.
Agreed.
Spielberg's films continually return to this idea of, you know, of, and I mean, if that's certainly crystallized in that Spielberg documentary, if you watch it through, that everything is about, you know, his father leaving when he was a
right.
child. And obviously,
it's about broken homes.
Everyone's been saying that about Spielberg for years. It's not necessarily a big thing, but it connects to these, like, if you have a family, then you're going to relate to what he is engaging with. And Zemeckis is interesting because he wants, clearly there's the Frank Capra influence, the Chuck Jones influence. He wants to appeal broadly to people. He wants to make these things that sweep people away. But he is, you know, naughty and contrarian in a way that feels incongruous with, you know, the scale of film he wants to make. So he wants to
right.
get that naughtiness in there. He wants to come at it from a weird angle. He wants to do something weird. And sometimes that it's there to I think it became there, and maybe I don't know, it becomes a more interesting thing where the films he makes are, in a sense, you think of something like Forrest Gump as being, oh, it's a universally loved film, and yet can you think part of the genesis for this entire podcast is how polarizing that film was,
right?
You know, in the sense that it was you know loved and made one Best Picture when it came out, and yet there still seems to be this sort of it seems to be quite hip to not like that film these
yeah.
days. And if you talk to, and certainly when we have attempted to discuss Zemeckis with other film people, it Forrest Gump for many people seems to be a bridge too far. Like they're afraid they're
right.
going to lose all their cool points if they admit, and that's an in, and that that's so interesting, and that's kind of why we're doing this.
Right.
Can't wait to make it to that podcast.
Same.
But anyway, that's, I think, another way in which, you know, just another way in which there's almost not more to chew on with Zemeckis, but a lot of stuff to chew on with Zemeckis, because you see that he is returning to many peculiar interests he has over and over again. But the way they manifest themselves, because they manifest themselves so differently with his films, his filmography is incredibly eclectic.
Right.
But you can see the relationship between, you know, what's going on in I Want to Hold Your Hand and what's going on in Roger Rabbit very, very, very clearly. It's just a little bit harder than just every movie's about a divorced family, which is, I think, a little bit easier for people
right.
to pick up on.
And I think that like you just said it right there, and something
I'm
that
sorry, Steven Spielberg, I would never characterize your whole filmography like that. But I'm just trying to,
we
trying
love
to
Spielberg.
Build
we
up
love
your
Spielberg.
Boy. I know that he listens to the podcast.
Yeah.
So.
But I think you hit on something that's really important there too. That Zemeckis's filmography is so eclectic. He didn't. Mm-hmm. He never made the same movie twice, unless you mm-hmm. count Back to the Future 2 and 3.
Was
but
it?
even those are
yeah,
they're
yeah.
basically the same. But they
I mean,
definitely
arguably arguably he made that film 3 times.
yes, but he did it with such a new tonal.
Yeah, yeah.
Spin with its own themes, and obviously they're weaker films because he didn't have 5 years to prep each of those. But
no, they're still fun, but they still work.
Yeah, but I think like when someone says, "Oh, well, he directed Forrest Gump," it's like that's overlooking so
much. It's like when we get to Death Becomes Her and all of that. It'll be lots of fun. That's some of the stuff I'm really excited to kind of to talk about.
I found that I'm excited for Death Becomes Her, one, because I haven't seen it. And also,
I know, you still haven't seen
found,
it.
I found a great bit of trivia that you're going to love, and I'm going to save it for that pod.
Okay,
Death
good.
Becomes Her.
I will continue to just briefly rewatch the movies right before we record and improvise the rest of the way through the podcast
additional research. I think don't worry. I'll check you.
Perfect.
Check you.
Perfect.
I don't want to kind of derail where we're at, but there's one thing that's just in my mind, and I want to say, because I've never put this together in my head before, and it's something so small. But it's when Marty is in his mom's bedroom and she's like obviously goo goo eyes for him. Mm-hmm. But when her mother yells, "Lorraine!" And she scrambles out of the room, she grabs his pants and obviously throws them at him. Mm-hmm. But she says, "Quick, put your pants back on," which I'd never thought about that line before, but the insinuation is that she took his pants off.
Yes.
That's what she did, which is so strange and weird, and it's glossed over so quickly. But
Well, because again, it's all lost in the Calvin Klein gag and then all that stuff. Which we keep going with all of that.
Like,
yeah, I don't know. That's what's so interesting. It's interesting to look at the whole mom relationship too, and what that means, and then all the weird stuff with the with the kissing, and again that stuff also. It's like, I remember, what is it, recently, some stand-up comedian, I think it was John Mulaney or something, did a whole bit about Back to the Future, where he's like, what a weird movie this is. What kind of weird psychopath would put this in a movie as opposed to anything else? And then as part of the bit, he talks about other things that the movie could be. Like, oh, so he goes back in time, so he's going to go, stop the JFK assassination? He's like, no, he's going to, mom's going to try and fuck him, blah, 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 as if stopping the JFK assassination would be a more sensible thing for a film to be about.
Right.
And my God, what a boring movie that would be if that's what the film were. This is so much more interesting and so much cooler than that.
And I think talking about the mom thing for let's sit on that for,
well,
for
and
minute,
just to wrap up that quick little idea
and
because that is often harped on, when you actually view it in the context of his filmography, you realize that that's why Robert Zemeckis came to the party, was to get that naughtiness in there, but not naughtiness for its own sake, but naughtiness that still plays into that whole Oedipal idea that is part of the humiliation of the father in the first part. I mean, it kind of goes without saying, but we'll do the short version of it for everybody. But the idea that the father is humiliated, and so Marty is feeling this desire that it's now falling to him. It is falling on him to save his household. That's why he tries to stand up to Biff, which is also, it's so good and I love that Zemeckis allows Michael J. Fox to be as short as Michael J. Fox is. It's just, obviously it's used for a bunch of Biff gags throughout, but he is a visual representation of that tension between boyhood and manhood. He's like, the previous generation seems to be, the washing machine appears to start to be shaking itself apart. There's nuclear proliferation. There's like trash in the streets, all of that. Is it my time to rise? And he's struggling with that. And a part of that is this idea that, of this tension of, should I become the man of the house, which is represented, I guess, Oedipally by the fact that his mother has lost any sexual attraction to the father, which is portrayed in that opening scene where she looks kind of disgusted at him while he
she just chugs vodka.
yes. And you realize also, and again, part of the whole thing, I mean, this on a just more surface level, obviously the film is about just empathy for your parents and realizing that, the previous gen, and
there's so much more. We're so much like our parents that we don't even realize.
Not unlike Marty, if he were going on a mushroom trip or something like that, and that's basically what going into the past is. It's kind of like this big psychedelic experience where he sees his father and his mother for who they are and yada, yada, yada. So he goes through the looking glass, whatever you want to say. It's about, and the empathy that he finds in his home. Like the empathy, again, with this parallel, as above, so below in the whole movie, you know, the empathy he finds in his own family for his parents, who he just cannot understand his dad. He cannot understand why his dad won't stand up for himself. He cannot understand why his mom married him. She just doesn't get it. Like in finding that empathy for them, he finds the answer for the larger questions, the questions about the world. Because when he finds that empathy for his dad, which is like his dad was in a really tough position and shit just sort of fell that way, or his mom was doing the best he could, or realizing that his mom was a woman who possessed sexuality, that his dad was kind of like him but also kind of not. By having that empathy for who they actually were as people, who he could relate to at his age, he no longer has to view the past in this binary way of was it good or bad. He has a more nuanced view of history, he has a more nuanced view of the atomic age, that hey, maybe it's not about was my dad, you know, right or wrong. It's not about that. It's about realizing that they were human beings. They were doing the best they could, and that's how you can maintain a respect generationally for where you come from, for the judgment of your parents, and at the same time be kind of critical at where some of those things have led us. And that's just a cool. It's about reconciliation. It's about transfiguration and unity and all that.
Taking part and actually having a dialogue, instead of like looking with disgust or shying away from it.
Which, by the way, in that, to finally get to the other, obviously the part where people like look at the end of Back to the Future and they say, "Oh, it's about 80s materialist excess or whatever." Again, not really, in the sense that it's about the transfiguration of that.
It's about
world
the power of love. It's about the power of love, Kyle.
Well, no, it's about the power of love in it, but it literally is, in the sense that the idea is that if Marty can reconcile these things about his dad, if he can reconcile these things about that generation and how it's led to this world, that he literally then will, and this is about that transition from boyhood to manhood, he will literally become efficacious to change the world around him into the world that he would like to see. And what happens, it happens through time machines instead of him getting a job, starting a company, becoming a politician, whatever the thing is. But he realizes that it is now his time, and we see it all represented. That's why everything is so much rosier in a kind of Wizard of Oz way at the end. And even when you have things like, you know, like people have criticized the film saying like, what? So like Biff tried to like rape the mom and then they just keep him around the house. It's stuff that kind of points to the fact that everything that happened in the past, I mean, it is, I think for the purposes of the movie, it literally happened, but it's more about it being Marty's dream world, it being about his interior self finally reconciling all of the things he doesn't understand about the present and doesn't understand the past and doesn't understand about himself and why he's impotent to fix it, and unifying those and then therefore transfiguring the entire world into this utopia, you know, at the end.
Where
even Biff has been recontextualized into something benign but not killed or pushed away or excluded from society. He has now been reintegrated in some other way. And there's ultimately a unity of all of the elements that you saw fighting each other in the beginning. So.
Right. Yeah. And even just looking at it, like talking about a lesson in 80s materialism, but it's like he finds a way to make his parents actually fall in love with each other. And how do you show that their lives are better because, one, his parents love each other and his father has learned to stand up for himself and to put himself out there and publish his stories and novels. So it's like the material success is just a visual to convey that because of these interior things are set right, that the world is now a better place.
The entire film. I mean, all art is about the fact that what is internal is connected to what is external, you know?
Right.
That's why when someone gets mad in a Kurosawa movie, the house can go on fire behind them, you know? Because it's about that, because it's like what exists on the other side of that membrane, what exists on the other side of the looking glass. So when he goes back in time, or when, when someone jumps through the movie screen or into Toon Land or whatever it is, it becomes an examination of what that person cannot reconcile about the world. And so it's the best sort of decoder ring for most of these films is just – wherever there's the real world, there's the banal life. Usually the camera doesn't move around too much. It sits still. Everything kind of sits still. And then when the camera starts to move a bunch and you hear a lot more music and a lot more talking and you see a lot more fantasy shit and you're entering whatever it is, time travel, a fantasy world, Toon Land, whatever it is, and this applies to Spielberg or anything else, just think, if this were a mushroom trip, because I know that's something generationally perhaps more people can relate to who listen to podcasts than actually looking like a little bit below the surface of these movies. But imagine if this were a mushroom trip that this guy were having about the life he were having in his real world and what he couldn't reconcile about that, then what would this mean about that? And if your film doesn't have that kind of dynamic relationship between the interior lives of its characters and the melodrama on the outside or the whatever's going on, and then that's not represented visually and all that, then your film feels kind of thin and hollow and flat, and it doesn't have that furnace. And so at the end, of course, if Marty fixes stuff internally and his parents just love each other, but the world has not been corrected, the world has not been made free of trash and free of all of those things, then the question still lingers. Like, Marty's solved his problem, but maybe he'll fail. Maybe he won't change the world around him. And the film doesn't just make the moral point, it makes the metaphysical point that if you can correct these things, you will change the world. It will follow, you know, so within, so without, all of that. So, yeah.
Yeah, that's well said, Kyle. Thank you.
Rad. And it has a rad thing at the end where he takes off. Oh, and by the way, we have to talk about it as a separate element. If it's so important, Robert Zemeckis literally shot it twice. But the entire coda at the end of the film, you know, which of course is rad because it's about a future car. And again, if you have look at Robert Zemeckis' whole car obsessed career up to this point, having a rad flying car be the pinnacle, which I'm sure was the big applause break moment at the end of the movie, with all that just huge release of energy at the end.
It flies! But,
yes, and because that has now been mythologized in the subsequent films, we view it as entirely a connective tissue to the sequels, but at the same time, look at what that actually means. Like, just imagine the sequels never could have or would have existed. Just look at what that thing on its own means for the film. Because I don't cynically view it as just, considering Robert Zemeckis' career up to this point had not been one that often begged for sequels because, films were expected to perform, then they didn't. He would not, 5 years later, they would shoot the next film. So this is not the kind of franchise world we live in now. Why
there was
have
no
that
ex-
on to the-
There was no expectation that
there was no expectation
sequel.
Of a sequel. So why have that at
they
the
even
end?
Said, because they even said that we would have never put her in the car if we knew we were making a sequel.
Oh, that's right. Because that's good. I have so much respect for the fact that they reshot it and didn't change it, you know, because that would have sucked if they changed it. But they recast Elizabeth Shue, which was great, and they fucking did that. But just to get to this point, why do that at the end? Because it says that the story, this great story, the story of this generational exchange, continues into the future. That, in other words, Marty,
it's
watch
not you.
Yourself.
It's
yes,
your
well,
kids.
Yeah, exactly. But notice that Doc Brown, having gone to the future, has already returned in crisis. So obviously the future is now also a fallen world, and that fallen world has something to do with a lesson that Marty, unlike his father, that Marty hasn't reconciled about himself. Now, ultimately, what he chooses for that is like Marty's, you know, aggressive masculinity.
What do you
think?
What
like,
are you, chicken?
The chicken. Yeah, exactly. And that's his flaw, which, you know, well, I, you know what? I am
we'll
very
we'll
interested
get,
to revisit
we'll
now. I'm very interested
Same.
To revisit now. Yeah. But it's just all about connecting into like, okay, anyway. So
it's
like
we
it
have
basically
to continue.
Says like
we have to continue. We have to continue to be vigilant and continue to have the conversations.
Yes.
Like
yes.
It's like
yes.
Yes. Just because one thing got fixed doesn't mean everything got fixed.
Rad.
One thing you skipped over that I want to say that I think is important, when the whole genesis for the story was Bob Gale saying, oh, well, what if he was looking through an old yearbook with his father in it and was like, oh, would I be friends with my father if I went back in time? And that was the genesis of the idea. And it became Back to the Future when Zemeckis says, yeah, and what if your mom wanted to fuck you? That's where the idea came from.
Perfect.
That's perfect, where the idea
that's perfect
came from.
Perfect Robert Zemeckis right there. Right. What I love, and here's what I love, is that, you know, another filmmaker, like a John Waters, say, might get this idea and then explore the idea of a mom wanting to fuck the son just purely on the sort of provocative, like the provocateur level of that.
Right.
But what Zemeckis does is that he nests that into a family film, or what it was, a popular family entertainment, and doesn't stop there. He makes it an integral part of a large sort of symbolic and metaphorical conversation about generational exchange. Zemeckis and Gale, but we go from that boyish, that naughty impulse, you know. But then he continues to. Like search for its meaning, and so they search for the meaning until they find it, and it's integrated. Like, it took them however many years they were able to work on the script because they couldn't get it made, but it ultimately is now such an integral piece to how the film works, we can't imagine it not being there. So totally. I don't know, it just represents an attitude where it's just like, and also in a sense, if you really want to tie it into some of the divine themes about the film, it represents kind of a work methodology that in some ways is kind of has faith that you can take these, you know, mm-hmm. faith, divine light, that right. has faith that you can take these boyish ideas, these naughty, like, impulses, these silly stories, this Chuck Jones, and if you look deeper, you can find resonant meaning. You can find a spirituality below the surface of all of these things. And he does. It's almost like when I talk about the film showing off, it's almost like, could I make a film where the mom tries to fuck the son, but it's still like the Frank
that's
Capra
his thing.
Movie I
it's
want
like,
to make.
It's
and
the
he does
anarchist.
It.
It's the anarchist
it.
In him. And I think you and I have talked about this a whole lot about just the idea of how do you create something that's fun and poppy and silly like mm-hmm. Zemeckis makes. And you can have these crazy, silly ideas, and just the process of mm-hmm. writing them and trying to figure out how they work. It just the idea gets battered and battered and battered, and it becomes like the fun that of mm-hmm. that original idea is something that is difficult.
Yes.
I think that's something so important about like the idea of, like you're saying, the idea for the movie is just, oh, what if your mom had the hots for you if you went back in time, mm-hmm. being the core piece. And it's not about JFK. It's not about anything, but we use the sci-fi thing to just make that absurdist film.
Yeah. But think about how that impulse, while it seems on the surface, and if you want to get really trippy here for a second, while it seems on the purpose to be a naughty impulse, think about where that led him. You know, if we're going to get really Campbellian and talk about the call here for a second, that idea that he gets this impulse, like, I don't know what it is. I just feel like the mom fucking the kid would be trying to fuck the kid would be like a fun element, but it stays in the movie the whole time. And ultimately, and depending on, again, how heady and trippy you want to get with this, ultimately reveals itself in the screenwriting process to be about what the film is about, like an emasculation of the father, like a sense that if we question these things about the greatest generation, if we question the whole 20th century's pushing all of its chips into science, technology, and atheism, and loses its spirituality and represses itself sexually, all of that. If it does all of that, if we question all of that, what does that say about your father's generation? Is it humiliating? You know, what does it say? All of that. So anyway, we're kind of talking in circles now. But
no, you're good. But yeah. The solutions were not apparent immediately. Like they've talked about the struggle of bringing it together, and like, oh well, how do we finish this plot line? Like that's
I totally lost my train of thought a second ago and just tried to fake my way out of it. But
no, you're good.
But think about how that mom impulse, because it immediately, or what's the first thing you think is like, okay, so it's an Oedipal story. And what's an Oedipal story? It's about a conflict between the son and the dad. And how that conflict between the son and the dad so perfectly is about like the generational conflict about all of this atomic shit. And so even though it's a dumb impulse, that impulse, you know, maybe that was like that beam of divine light that came down and struck the tower, and that maybe it was pointing at something far, far, far more profound. And I don't know. I have found in you know, creative work and anything else, that sometimes those naughty little impulses that won't get out of your mind, or just dumb ideas,
they're there for a reason.
They're there for a reason, and they point you at what is the real meaning of the thing sometimes. And so, and I, yeah, it's just a type of screenwriting and just an approach to storytelling that I think has, I think there has just been a loss of generational knowledge with regard to what filmmakers were thinking about in the 70s, which was, I think, as a, and in the, but influencing into the 80s and all of that, which I think there was just much more spiritually attuned than just, again, because I mean, a lot of the golden age of Hollywood was born from the counterculture and taking a bunch of drugs and getting really into heady, weird shit. By the way, I recently rewatched The Trip, 1967, directed by Roger Corman. We'll talk about it later. I'll,
sure.
Richard, a little sidebar conversation.
Right.
Rewatched it. It's great. But I think that, and maybe on some level, and I'm kind of just getting to this now here, but I think on some level, maybe even Back to the Future is about that in a way, in the sense that there was a kind of mythic and spiritual storytelling and an idea of that growing. I don't know. There was a more spiritual aspect to filmmaking, certainly when Robert Zemeckis was coming up, that maybe he felt was being lost. And maybe this re-injection of spirituality right before he crashes into the movie theater at the end was Zemeckis trying to say, even if he wasn't in full conscious possession of this at the time, that like, hey, remember when we told movies about this kind of mythic stuff?
Right.
And like, then, and what happened on the literal level was kind of less important and more symbolic. Can we start making that kind of story again? And then he, the lightning bolt said yes, and so he made Roger Rabbit.
Yeah. And then kept doing that.
And just kept doing that.
Just kept doing that.
Yeah.
There's kind of two small things that I saw.
I want to see his Beatles movie that he just not got a chance to make.
Oh my God, I want to see that so bad. Can you imagine? Oh, so good. We'll talk about that.
Peter Serafinowicz was cast to play Paul McCartney. And that would be great.
We'll get to Nancy Allen
back in that movie. That's what we need to do.
And Eddie Deason.
Man, we need to get the Deason on this podcast. Yeah. Do you think we could? Could we pull an Eddie Deason interview, Richard?
Yeah, for Polar Express, maybe.
Yeah. Oh, is he in Polar Express?
Yeah, he's the annoying kid.
Oh, it has been so long since I've seen Polar Express. Man, I love the loyalty also of just returning to these people over and over again. Like the fact that Mary Jo Sperber is in everything, you know, and it's just sort of like, I don't know, you get it. It's like that kind of thing that, you know, if you've ever worked on projects, you just want to bring people along
who you like
and who you love, especially if maybe previous projects didn't work out. You want to kind of continue to bring them along. And so there's just something very heartening about seeing Mary Jo Sperber and all these other people pop up in his movies over and over again. So I like it. Anyway.
Yeah. We don't have to dwell on this, but just going back to his like weird perverse his weird perverse tendencies, like his dad is a peeping Tom.
which is something done. That is actually a really good point, because I think of it as, yeah, you're right. It's part of the perversion. You know, it's like, it's naughty, it's whatever. And it's about the mom and the dad's relationship. That's why she doesn't respect him, whatever. But at the same time, even that in itself is what the rest of the humiliation of George McFly over the subsequent generations is about. Is he is not the kind, he's the person who stood outside and he looked. He was an observer to reality.
Literally through the looking glass.
Thank you, Richard. Oh, man. See, now we're synchronizing, Richard.
Yeah,
we're right there. We're in tune now.
Yeah. There's so much of that weird perverse energy in the film that, again, we get swept. Mm-hmm. It sweeps us so far behind, and they're just kind of gags here and there that it's not, we're on to the next gag so fast.
I don't know. We've said so much about fucking Back to the Future. The one point I want to harp on over and over again is, it's a perfectly structured screenplay. Yeah, every shot is impeccable and incredible and all of that. But, you know, he had that already in the bag on a couple of other things, you know. And so look a little bit, because it's weird when you try and engage people with these kind of conversations about a film like Back to the Future, about
Forrest
you know,
Gump,
whatever.
Maybe.
There's this weird thing where I think especially in the age of kind of YouTube, people have become so obsessed with formalism in movies mm-hmm. because it's easy to create video essays about that. You know, and like this shot next to this shot next to this shot. And I love that. I think those are fantastic educational tools.
Easier to see. It's easier to see.
Yeah. Oh, for sure.
I'm guilty of that as much as the next guy.
Oh yeah, but that's the thing is that I just think there's so much more to not just more to the movie, but there's so much more to be mined from, you know, why does this movie resonate the way it does? Like if a film resonates, you know, that strongly with that many people, begin looking because at that point things as simple as your choice of subject, you know, your choice of story, your choice of theme, those, again, they're the furnace that's going to heat everything else. And so we have to really look at those. And so it's the kind of thing where, like, is Back to the Future engaging in this conversation? Like, it has to be. It has to be engaging because that's why so many people have seen it so many times.
It's not an accident.
I also love that we've made it this deep into the podcast and we've never said the name Eric Stoltz once. I have to mention that every other podcast about Back to the Future is like, did you know that Eric Stoltz was cast in the movie?
And I'm glad we haven't talked about it. I do want to touch not on the Stoltz part. Well, there is mm-hmm. one thing I read about the Stoltz thing when he was fired. They told Christopher Lloyd, and his response was, "Who's Eric?" The person that told him was like, "Marty." And then Christopher Lloyd goes, "Oh, I thought his name was actually Marty," because Stoltz was so method on set, he was making everybody call him Marty. So Christopher Lloyd just didn't know.
Gotcha. So that makes a lot more sense.
Your joke. But I do want to touch, not to touch on like the he was cast and whatever. But I looked into like mm-hmm. they shot for 6 weeks, 25 days of like mm-hmm. a 70 day schedule,
which is insane.
And then, like, they started shooting in late November. This is what I want to talk about, just the production mm-hmm. challenges of it that get glossed mm-hmm. over when you just say, oh, Stoltz was cast, recast mm-hmm. in the middle of it. They shot, mm-hmm. like, a third plus of the movie with Stoltz. And then, luckily, they started shooting at the end of November. So they had, like, 10 days, 2 weeks between Christmas and New Year's, where I imagine Zemeckis and Spielberg and the studio head were just sitting down being like, how do we get Michael J. Fox in this role? And then they shot for another week and a half mm-hmm. when they got back. And like they were shooting just coverage of Doc Brown. And then they would turn to Zemeckis and be like, okay, should we get the setup of Marty now? And he'd be like, no, we'll get that later. We'll get that later. So just from a pure production looking at it, like, and I estimate it's like 70 days, but this became a 100-day shoot. Zemeckis has said it was the shoot that would never end. And if you consider the situation that they were in with having to have Michael J. Fox, because they were borrowing him with off of Family Ties mm-hmm. at the time. So they were only shooting nights and weekends. Mm-hmm. So it's like a month of night shoots.
I mean, yeah, and that's the thing about it is like I'm glad, I'm sure, reference any other podcast if you want to listen to for that thing, because I'm sure that's been enumerated, but it is an incredible story worth telling, which is just the fact that I shot for like half the movie with Eric Stoltz, which makes all the sense in the world now why he was replaced, when you realize, not no disrespect to Eric Stoltz, but you realize that like a very serious method actor is not really going to probably strike the same tone as everyone else. Then this very, very, very well-defined performance style, this very big performance style, and here's Michael J. Fox coming straight from television. You know, he's able to play bigger and broader. He's able to play all of that kind of stuff. So that makes sense. And then the realization that not only did they shoot half the movie, have to restart over again, basically, with a whole new lead actor, and
they had to call the production design to put art department because they were redressing Hill Valley. Mm-hmm. They were
And that's the thing is that, and just to touch on this, that the reason they didn't originally cast Michael J. Fox is because he was still shooting Family Ties. Yep. He literally, like he had, even as they shot the film, a scheduling conflict. He was simultaneously shooting Family Ties. And my favorite anecdote I remember hearing years ago was that Michael J. Fox would basically sleep 2 hours a night because he would shoot Family Ties all day and then get on a plane and then like get like go shoot Knights on Back to the Future and come back. And they said that he would fall asleep in his bed and then for 2 hours, and then so that he could continue to sleep, he would be physically carried from his bed to the car. And just thinking about how small Michael J. Fox is, I think that that's adorable. And I want just – I feel like if I want a painting in my house someday – to represent how my love of Back to the Future, it would be some PA, just burly PA, just carrying a tiny Christ-like Michael J. Fox, sacrificing his body to make this movie happen.
Yeah.
So God bless Michael J. Fox.
So I don't want to dwell on it, but it's interesting just talking about the amount they had to reshoot and like that's – I didn't know how much they had shot. It's like – it was a huge – ordeal. And to continue that, because I love all the production notes and stuff, like they were originally slated for I think a May release, so they got pushed back to August, and then they finished shooting on April 12th. The release was pushed back to August. They did a test screening. The test screening went super well, so they moved the release back to July 3rd. So they basically had 10 weeks to edit the movie, edit the movie, do the score, and do the only 32 effect shots, which sounds crazy that there's only 32 effect shots. But and so
once you get to the past, it's the past.
It's the past.
It's also just when effects were so much harder, and so the number of effect shots didn't range into the thousands.
Yeah, and so those were finished, of course, a week before release. But just thinking about like doing all of post in 10 weeks for a movie like this that we hold in such high regard is kind of a heroic.
It's incredible.
It's a heroic feat.
Yeah, and we didn't even talk. I mean, there's so many other things to talk about, like Alan Silvestri's score, one of the most iconic scores in the history of cinema, one in which, you know, you could just add that little ding-ding-ding, and there's adds a little bit of magic into the world with the in the big themes that still, you know, kind of make the hair stand up on the back of your neck. I mean, it was every bit the score that this film needed. The John Williams score to Star Wars was this score that film needed. And I don't know, I'm just a big Alan Silvestri fan, so that's a whole other thing that we can keep talking about on we'll have more time to talk about Alan Silvestri actually on the rest of the Back to the Future podcast.
And I think I want to bring this up on in terms of Silvestri. Obviously the score is amazing, but apparently Spielberg hated the Romancing the Stone score. And Zemeckis told Silvestri, he's like, Spielberg wants something that's big, grand, and epic. So like that was the direction. And just I was thinking about that earlier today. That was the note. And thinking about this movie that's a pretty small family drama, right? But it has this big epic theme that when my brain tries to grapple with it, it's like, well, that doesn't feel like that should be the first direction that it's given, or it probably shouldn't work, but it imbues all of the actions with such heroism.
Definitely one of the bigger you're talking about Star Wars' influence on this, definitely one of the bigger things there. But it's so funny because I love, it's so interesting to hear that as like outside input, in the sense that it's so much a part of what the film is, and it's kind of interesting to look at in retrospect with regard to the score to Romancing the Stone, because if you remember, a lot of the score to Romancing the Stone isn't what we generally associate, or what I had previously associated with Alan Silvestri. It sounds kind of like the A Fish Called Wanda score. It's like funky synth bass, you know, hey, 80s contemporary music, along with then mixing in more romantic ideas to create that really cool contrast between the fantasy world and the real world. But here in this movie, it's like, you know what? That epic score underlying it's like it just goes from dream world to like super dream world.
Two final things that I saw watching this again. One, it just speaking to the anarchist that Zemeckis is, what is the day that he goes back in time to when time travel is invented? November 5th. Guy Fawkes Day. Remember, the 5th of November.
Oh, that's so funny. Oh, probably not an accident.
Probably not an accident at all. And the, what's the other thing? God, I wanted to, the comic book that the kid is holding is, of course, Amazing Stories, which is, of course, his next film. Not an accident. That's also in there too. And speaking of, that's a great way to end, because that's the next episode where we'll be watching Amazing Stories.
And oh, that's like that's a TV thing, right? Or what is it? Again, it was Amazing Stories.
It was a TV show, but then they took his episode and Spielberg's episode and some other director's episode and released them theatrically. So,
gotcha. Cool. It's can't wait to engage with that. And then what do we have after that? Is it Roger Rabbit?
Back to the Future. No, it's Roger Rabbit. So next time we'll do Amazing Stories, which is his television segment with his original short films, which I'm stoked.
Shorts are the ones I'm really excited to finally see, because I know that if John Milius called them socially irresponsible, then I am stoked.
Yeah. So so it's been great. I love Back to the Future. There's so much more we could talk about, but we gotta cut it off. We gotta cut it off somewhere. But Kyle, this was a great conversation about this fucking
movie.
There's
so much more to this film than the fact that they use note cards to write it, as it turns out.
So much more.
Let's dive in. No, I love it, man. Well, cool. It also makes me excited to talk about the sequels and stuff. So Richard, this has been fun.
So I'm at Bob Zemeckis on Instagram. Kyle, how do we find
you? We can't really, I feel like we don't want to bury the lead there and say that Richard's Instagram handle is Bob Zemeckis, the regular spelling, just that. I'm at Mr. Kyle Bogart on an increasingly less active Instagram account in these dark, dark times. But that's where you can find me. And
we'll catch y'all buttheads later with Amazing Stories.
Boom. Later, buttheads.